I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. In English, Reina Grande means Grand Queen. But author and memoirist Reina Grande hasn't always felt like she's gotten the royal treatment as an immigrant, a college student, and a writer. Grande was only two when her father left her home of Iguala, Mexico, to find work in the U.S. Her mother followed 2 years later. Grande made her own journey north at the age of nine. Grande's 2012 best-selling memoir, The Distance Between Us, told of her life before and after illegally immigrating from Mexico to the U.S. The follow-up to that book is the memoir, A Dream Called Home. In it, Grande shares stories about the challenges she faced growing up in impoverished Iguala, leaving her homeland, losing her mother tongue, and finding herself and a new home. Fronteras contributor Yvette Benavides had a chance to speak with Reina Grande in advance of her book's release on October 2nd.
What made The Distance Between Us so groundbreaking to me was that it was an immigrant story told by an immigrant, written by her. And in this book, A Dream Called Home, it seems somehow all the more miraculous and remarkable for the same reasons, but in 2018. But I imagine that with the positive response, with the idea that we need this story now in 2018, that there could also be the potential for a negative response. Have you anticipated that?
I thought about it, but I have not let myself get carried away with thinking about those negative voices. I want to focus on more on why I wrote the book and why I wanted to share it. And I want to think about those young people, especially, who really need a story like this for inspiration, for encouragement. Those are the people that I'm really thinking about now, not about the other ones.
Because this takes us through these years when you were in university. There were so many things that occurred that were a consequence of your not being oriented or guided along in this context of being. I mean, it's hard enough for anybody, let alone somebody with your background. I mean, even your name caused issues in classes where professors not only didn't pronounce your name correctly, but didn't even try to do so. And to me, that seemed in that scene in the book about that professor that mispronounced your name, also a kind of indifference to you. It wasn't that they mispronounced the name, it's that they didn't care to know how to pronounce it. And that just spoke volumes about other issues that you were experiencing. What did that experience teach you?
I think it's something that we experience a lot in the Latino community and other communities too with our names, that they just get butchered, you know. And not only do they get butchered, but the people who are saying our names don't try to pronounce them correctly and to respect our culture and our identity. And it's a big deal when you go around life being made fun of and having your name butchered all the time. Mm-hmm. It definitely affected me in that, you know, I hated my name. Mm-hmm. I really hated it, and I always had such a rough time at school when teachers would take roll call and say my name aloud, and I cringed all the time. So that's not a good way to live your life, you know, when you're so self-conscious about everything that you are, including the name that your parents gave you.
I can certainly empathize with you about your name, but I do have to say to you, every time I mention your name to somebody, like in the context of, have you read Reina Grande? Almost everybody always says, she has the best name, you know, so, you know, so things can change, but I totally understand where you're coming from. When you're young, You don't need one more thing to make you feel different.
Yeah, I think I've had that experience too, where people, one of the questions I get a lot is, you know, they're like, is Reina Grande your name? Like, is that really your name? And I say, yes, I wouldn't pick this as a pen name, you know? It's, no, it's kind of funny because I feel that I chose the perfect profession for this name. It's a good writer's name.
You also experience something I think a lot of us do with this kind of dual identity, a dual identity of feeling not quite American and not quite Mexican enough. Do you still grapple with those feelings that you describe in the book?
Oh, yeah, I do. You know, it's so much better now than before when I was younger. And I feel that as an adult, I have enough maturity to try to comprehend this dual identity and to try to feel comfortable in both. But there are times when I experience that conflict, that inner conflict again. And the question, where do I belong, continues to come back to me. I had a somewhat of a traumatic experience last year, and I would like to explore this experience more in my writing later on, but A Dream Called Home was translated in Spanish by a professional translator in Mexico City. And I had translated The Distance Between Us myself, even though my Spanish is not perfect. But it was my way of trying to reclaim my mother tongue because all of my writing is done in English, not Spanish. So I did the translation, but I received, through the past 6 years that the book's been out, I've gotten emails once in a while from people telling me that there are mistakes in the book. And I know there are mistakes because my Spanish has a lot of mistakes. So this time my editor decided to hire a professional translator to do it. And I said, okay, because I was insecure. And when he sent back that translation, it was so traumatic to read my own work in my mother tongue in an unfamiliar language almost, because the Spanish that the translator used was not the Spanish I speak. And he used this very fancy vocabulary, and I had to look up words in the dictionary to read my own work in my mother tongue. I was looking up words in a dictionary, and it was very traumatic for me because it sounded nothing like me. But then it made me aware of my limitations with my Spanish. So then I went back to that insecurity again, right? That the people who say I'm not Mexican enough are right. They're right because I cannot speak Spanish the way a Mexican translator in Mexico uses Spanish, since I couldn't understand his translation. So it was traumatic, and it hurt me a bit. And then also the other thing that happened was I started to think of this alternate universe, an alternate reality where I never came to the U.S., but I stayed in Mexico and I went to school in Mexico and went to college and got my degree over there. And I started to fantasize that that's the way the Mexican Reina Grande would have spoken, with that beautiful, fancy language. So then it made me think about, like, this is what I lost when I immigrated. And then, of course, I had to remind myself that if I had stayed in Mexico and not come here, I wouldn't even have gone to college because we were too poor to go to school, and I would have ended up being somebody's maid instead. So I reminded myself that, no, there is, in an alternate reality, there would not be a college-educated Mexican Reina. No way.
Wow, what a complicated situation, because when I hear you say they were right, I'm not Mexican enough, that's a very difficult thing to say, let alone accept about yourself. Like, who gets to say what are the markers, you know, what level of proficiency in your mother tongue, for instance. So, I mean, you were a single mother when you were working as a teacher and studying and making your way on this journey to become a writer and all of those challenges. And now you have another child. I mean, I think those questions about our identity can become even more complicated with our children and for our children. Have you encountered that with your kids?
Yeah, definitely. One of my biggest struggles right now as a mother is the realization that I am a Mexican immigrant who is mother to two middle-class American children. And their childhood is so, so different from my own. So different that sometimes I feel like an outsider at home. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I struggle to connect with my children. And yeah, they're just this sense of alienation sometimes that I feel. And I try to talk to my kids about, you know, my experiences as an immigrant. Both of my children have read The Distance Between Us. I take them to Mexico every year so that they can see where I come from. So I'm constantly trying to work on making sure that there's a connection between us, because I don't want to feel that alienation. You know, I don't want to look at my children and not know how to connect. At the same time, I think sometimes it's kind of painful for me because I work so hard to make sure that I was successful enough that I could provide my children the things that I didn't have as a child. At the same time, because of all those things I've been able to provide for my children, I also worry that one, you know, they might not appreciate it as much as I would like them to, or two, that they're not learning how to suffer and how to build up stamina and how to be hungry enough that they learn how to fight for the things that they want, the goals that they have. So these are things that I do worry about, having this cushy middle-class American life.
Mm-hmm. That really is the takeaway from reading this book, is mm-hmm. the sheer force of will, the ganas, the desire, the hard work, the work ethic, the, you know, putting aside the fun things that college students do so that you can go and write your stories and study for your tests and so on. I mean, there is something very instructive in this book that I think does connect with young people.
I don't see a lot of books like that, you know, a lot of books that where Latinos go to college. And I really want to make sure that people know that, yes, we do. You know, we go to college. There's so many Latino working professionals out there with degrees and doctors. I think it's important that we begin to tell these stories of our college experience, of our success in our chosen professions.
That's Fronteras contributor Yvette Benavides speaking with author Reina Grande. Grande's latest book is A Dream Called Home, published by Atria Books. Coming up on Fronteras, San Antonio's oldest public housing project was an upgrade for residents when they were built in 1941, but they're in need of improvement.
The construction's old. It's really hard to retrofit in that regard. So the new developments provide that opportunity, that springboard, that chance that gives everybody to say, hey, you know what? I'm really going to succeed with the support of others.
but some fear redevelopment could fracture the culture that grew out of West Side San Antonio's Alasan Apache Courts. That's coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. In 1921, a devastating flood struck San Antonio. Of the 52 who died, 47 lived on the west side. Already living in substandard homes, displaced residents were left in even more dire straits. A local priest, Father Carmelo Tranchesi, lobbied politicians for a public housing project to house residents of the mostly Hispanic impoverished neighborhood. After the project nearly stalled, Tranchesi wrote to First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, asking for her support. After her assurances that the project would go ahead, building began. The Alasan Apache Courts were the first public housing project in San Antonio. Built in 1941, the buildings were a revelation for Westsiders, residents who had no outdoor plumbing and who lived in wooden shacks with dirt floors now had roofs over their heads and running water. A new exhibit, Los Courts, highlights the residents and culture that grew out of the projects. In the Courts Community Center, tall panels present pictures and stories detailing the history of the courts, including the notable residents who once made their homes there. 91-year-old Lilia Vela was making the rounds of the community center in her wheelchair. She was particularly proud to point out a picture on those panels showing a just-married young couple photographed outside the courts. That's her and her husband, Manuel, in 1947. Vela was one of the court's original residents.
We lived in the courts for 20 years with my mother when we were children. My husband and I got married, and we had 5 children, 3 girls, 2 boys.
The now widowed Vela says the best memories she had of the courts were of simply having a roof over her head.
Most of all, the bathroom, having a toilet, having a bathtub, where we didn't have that when we used to live in the old neighborhoods. I didn't have that.
Another product of the courts is Blanca Gonzalez. San Antonians might know her best as Blanca Rosa, a member of the vocal group Las Tesoros de San Antonio. This vivacious 84-year-old also holds good memories of growing up in the courts.
They used to have like arts and crafts and games and everything for the young people. Basketball, I used to play basketball. Yes, it was something. I grew up here. I'm very proud to have grown up in the Alasan Apache Courts.
The Alasan Apache Courts are 1 to 2-story concrete structures with metal doors and no doorbells. There is no laundry room for residents, and most units have no central air, relying instead on window units. Free Wi-Fi is only available in the community room. What was once a step up for residents back in 1941 is considered substandard today. The San Antonio Housing Authority has been conducting public housing renovations and redevelopments across the city. David Nizavacha is president and CEO of SAHA. He says the 70-plus-year-old concrete buildings are due for redevelopment.
You know, a lot of our new developments, we're putting in connectivity to the digital access so people can actually have free Wi-Fi so they can gain access to the internet, which I believe is a basic utility everybody should have, because no matter where you live, you shouldn't be condemned to a life of poverty. You should have the same opportunities. So that doesn't happen here in these developments. The construction's old. It's really hard to retrofit in that regard. So the new developments provide that opportunity, that springboard, that chance that gives everybody to say, hey, you know what? I'm really going to succeed with the support of others, and the Housing Authority wants to be a major partner in that role.
But there are some opposing voices to redevelopment, which would require a temporary relocation of residents. Graciela Sanchez is director of the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center, a nonprofit that promotes social justice as well as the arts and culture of San Antonio's West Side.
How will the schools be affected? Will the new occupants have children? Will those children And those parents that are middle to upper class want to send them to low performing schools. You know, the social network also, right? People might live in the courts, but their abuelitas or their tías, they live in the surrounding areas. And they need that for the babysitting. They need that for, you know, that network. When you shut that down and people are also sent away somewhere else, they're not going to have the same social network that they had here. So it's going to affect San Antonio dramatically.
But pride in San Antonio's West Side is what brings residents and visitors to the exhibit's opening. And singer Blanca Rodriguez, who left the courts decades ago, never fails to tout her orgullo.
Yes, but I am very, very proud to be a member of the West Side of San Antonio. Everywhere where I perform, either by myself or with the girls, I always mention that I'm from the West Side.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Corazón.